Sunday Baroque Conversations is made possible by the Friends of Sunday Baroque and is produced at WSHU Public Radio in Fairfield, Connecticut. I'm Suzanne Bona. Thanks for listening. Don't miss an episode of Sunday Baroque Conversations. Subscribe on Apple, Google, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. And please leave us a review. If you want to find out where you can listen to our weekly show, visit our website, sundaybaroque.org, for a station list and our 24/7 stream. Again, that's sundaybaroque.org. Countertenor Anthony Roth Costanzo's performing experiences have included operas, films, concerts and recitals, and even Broadway. The 2020 winner of the Metropolitan Opera's Beverly Sills Award and the Opera News Award also won a Grammy Award in 2022 for Best Opera Recording for Philip Glass's Akhenaten. It is a two-act opera based on the life and religious convictions of an Egyptian pharaoh. Anthony Roth Costanzo joins me on Zoom to talk about some of his musical achievements so far and some of his future hopes and dreams. Thank you very much and welcome.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be with you.
So let's dial this all the way back to the beginning. How did you first start making music, and when did you first start making music? Were you singing right out of the box, or were you playing an instrument?
Well, when I was about 6 years old, I started taking piano lessons, as many kids do. And, you know, I was never good at reading the music from the page and translating it into my fingers. So I had this incredible piano teacher, Peifin Liu, in North Carolina, where I grew up. And she said, maybe you should try singing the music. And immediately I connected to the act of singing and the feeling of singing. And I loved it. Some of the first music I sang was George Gershwin. And that led me to want to go audition for local plays in North Carolina. And then it became state plays. And then by the time I was 11, I told my parents, two psychologists at Duke University, that I thought I had really done all there was to do in North Carolina and I should go to New York City. And so I moved to New York with my parents sort of taking a sabbatical or going back and forth. And I went on Broadway and did Broadway national tours and plays and all kinds of things until I was about 13. And I was asked to do an opera. And it was Benjamin Britten's The Turn of the Screw. And I was so fascinated by the complexity with which emotions were expressed in opera as compared to all of the musical theater I had been doing, which was so full of life and fun, but didn't have that layered way of expressing the human experience. And I think 13 was the perfect age, and I was really drawn to that. And so that's how I first got drawn to classical music.
Wow. So you sort of scooped my next question, which was to ask about your family. They were psychologists. Interesting. But they did sign you up for piano lessons. So clearly they had an appreciation for music and a desire for you to experience music.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think my mother's father was a violinist. I never met him, but, you know, and my dad sang around the house, Frankie Valli. So he was really singing in falsetto when I was a little kid, you know, and so there was always music around. And I think they loved the idea of it. But they didn't know anything about opera or musical theater per se. So it was something we discovered all together, which was a wonderful family adventure.
Wow, the whole Frankie Valli thing, that's prophetic.
It was, indeed.
Wow. So when and how did you really realize, or maybe it was in that period, that music is your life's work? I mean, did you have this moment that you thought, okay, well, that's it? Or was it just sort of always understood, or just part of the evolution?
Well, I was really drawn to the arts in general, you know, music and theater. Theater is how I began, and music as an extension of that. But then when I was 15 years old, I was cast in a Merchant Ivory film playing a kid who loved opera. And then we changed it eventually into a kid who sang opera. And I got exposed to this whole world of film and art and the visual arts, and also to a choreographer named Carol Armitage and the ballet she was making that she wanted me to sing in. So, you know, by the time I was 18, I was exposed to a whole variety of disciplines. And of course, opera is It's the most interdisciplinary art form in a way that incorporates everything from fashion in the costumes to art in the set design to ballet and music, theater, poetry, story, all of those things. And so it seemed like the most complete form to explore. And by the time I went to college, I went and did my undergrad at Princeton. I was feeling the need to understand history, psychology, you know, ethics, all these other issues that also come up in the stories that are told with opera. And so it felt clear to me that I wanted to be a performer and more than a performer, actually a creator, someone who enabled art to happen, however that was, because I saw it as a way to express all of these different things that I was encountering in my life.
I'm so glad you brought that up about the desire to be a creator, because that is one thing. You know, your career really encompasses so many different genres and so many different approaches to music making, so many different angles of it. And I wondered whether when you set out as a professional musician or as a professional, if you intentionally pursued all those different paths. Or so it sounds like it was much more organic.
To a certain extent it was, but I also, you know, was very captivated in high school by reading Machiavelli. And so, you know, I was intent on making things happen in a way that made sense to me. So at Princeton, I developed a performance project for my senior thesis. And I remember saying to them, you know, I need $35,000. That's the budget we've put together. There are professional artists from James Ivory to Carol Armitage, and there are student performers, and there are sets and lights and costumes and things being made in Venice. And, you know, I put all of this stuff together. And they said, well, we can only give you $1,000. And I said, well, there's got to be a way. And so I came up with a scheme to sell the project through 11 different proposals to 11 different departments, and to go to the chairs of those departments and say, well, you see, you know, English is a big part of this, or comparative literature or history or gender studies or whatever is a big part of this project. And look at all of these other people who are already involved. Don't you want this to be a big university-wide arts collaboration? And that usually would get me a few thousand dollars from the chair's discretionary fund. And then I convinced the university to spend an additional $120,000 making a film of it, which I led, and which eventually went to Cannes and played on PBS. So I was always intent on not only creating the work, but also figuring out how to extend its life, how to make it as legible as possible to as many people as possible. Mm-hmm. And as I grew through my 20s and really learned the craft of art and went to the Manhattan School of Music as a conservatorian and learned the nitty-gritty of technique and what it takes to sing, I always developed this idea of creating points of access, not only for audiences to access what we do, but for us to access other people's stories that we weren't telling already in our field.
You've just sort of outlined a little bit of what's going on, but you really have had quite not only extraordinary and marvelous success, but a real whirlwind. Your life is pretty pretty hectic on a moment-by-moment basis. And I know that just in the weeks leading up to this conversation we're having right now, you finished performing Rhodolinda at the Met in New York. You went to Vegas for the Grammys. You jetted off to Budapest for an early music festival. Now you're back in Boston. You're going to be heading off like in a couple of days back to New York for rehearsals again at the Met, this time for the Glass, Akhenaten again. And all of these projects, obviously, are very exciting and very important and meaningful to you. But I wonder how you keep it together, how you stay focused, and frankly, how do you stay healthy?
Well, I think it's really important to get 8 hours of sleep. That's the thing I figured out for my voice is the best. Sometimes that means 10 hours of trying to sleep. But, you know, it's that I see as part of my job. Mm-hmm. And then the other thing is how you manage your time. And, you know, as an opera singer, you've only got really 2 hours of voice or so. So, you know, you can be in rehearsal for 6 hours or you can be practicing for 2 hours. But at the end of the day, if you're sleeping 8 hours, you're still left with 16, 15, 14 other hours. And even if you took 4 of those or 3 of those to relax, you're left with a considerable amount of time. And even if after your rehearsal and after you're practicing, you've only got 4 or 5 other hours. There's a lot you can do in that time if you're focused. And so I tend to sort of pace things out instead of cramming for a project that I'm doing the week before, the night before. I say, well, why don't I do 30 minutes of that scene today? And then I'll do 30 minutes of that other project and I'll send this email for an hour. And, you know, so I try and move forward on a lot of fronts simultaneously in any given day. And I found that if I give myself lead time, I'm less stressed about it and I have a little more control over things.
Yeah, yeah. And it's time management, really, in the simplistic way of putting it. But what a great lesson, too, for your students, because I think that that's one thing that's not always addressed. I bet that that's a really important piece of what you can help them with. I'm curious to know, you are teaching at your alma mater, Princeton. What's that like? How do you like teaching? How did your own experiences as a student affect what kind of teacher you are?
You know, I've taught at Princeton, as you know, I've taught a course there, and I've also gone back to lecture, and I teach many master classes and things like that. And I think I get so much joy learning from the students, because I remember what it was like to be a student and how I felt I really had ideas and a drive. And I wanted to get information from the professors and I try and give them my experience. But what I'm most interested in is understanding how they perceive what it is that I'm trying to do and how they think it could be done better, because ultimately the audiences we want to get are their age and are those students. And so I want to understand how they're thinking about things. And it gives me a lot of inspiration and a lot of excitement about how to reform and transform the field of the arts.
Yeah, yeah. So let's talk about a couple of your specific projects. I watched the live stream of that Extraordinary Glass production. It was mind-blowing.
Thank you.
Yeah. Could you please talk about preparing for that? Maybe you have some interesting anecdotes. I mean, that was quite a handful, the difficult music and the complicated staging, the nudity. I mean, like, it's a big, big deal.
It is a real marathon, and it is, you know, opera singing is already the Olympics of singing in some ways, you know, and that is the most taxing role I think I've ever done. It's almost 4 hours on stage for me, and it's very slow moving physicality, very extended and challenging vocalization. But I think what's so wonderful about it, both for the audience and the performer, is that you have to enter into a kind of ritual. And that it almost evokes the ideas and the spirits and the images of ancient Egypt. And more than that, the ideas of this pharaoh, Akhenaten, who was potentially the first monotheist. So understanding what it is that I need to do as a performer, first of all, to be able physically and vocally to do the performance, but then also to be able to create a world without very much text and without very much narrative line. How can I engage an audience for 4 hours in the way that I perform something and the way that I create images for myself that they can almost see or interpret in their own way? And so it's a kind of mystical experiment. And it sounds almost like, you know, I've been to a Zen retreat or something. But what I've seen in the hundreds of thousands of people who've seen it, be it in London, New York, LA, is that it really does work. People get sort of mesmerized and people feel the sort of accumulation of all the artistry happening on stage. And the way that we have to approach that is by creating our own kind of ritual. And that's an extension of what performance always is, in a way, is this beautiful creation of ritual through an art form that helps us connect to an audience and draw them in.
Mm-hmm. Do you recall how you became involved in that project? I mean, it really is also, you know, as someone who does all of this Baroque opera as well, that's sort of the opposite or the other side of the same coin in a way.
Yeah. I mean, I had had this on my radar as a potential opera and talked with my managers at Opus 3, the wonderful Caroline Woodfield had mentioned this as an idea and brought it to my attention. And so when it came up that that English National Opera was going to do a new production of it. And we went in to talk to them about it, and they were excited to work with me on it. I was really thrilled because I thought, you know, having the chance to work with the director, Phelan McDermott, and the conductor, Karen Kamensek, who are both total luminaries and total glass experts. I knew that we could create something that was really unlike any other opera production I had participated in. And also the subject, the more I read about Akhenaten and the more I understood how Philip Glass kind of infused the ideas of Akhenaten into his compositional method, the more excited I got about adding my voice to that beautiful work.
Yeah. So another one of your projects is as the artist in residence at the New York Philharmonic, where you are performing and curating programming on questions of identity. And that's also a pretty significant part of what you do. How are you approaching that? And can you maybe give some examples?
Yeah, I mean, when the New York Phil asked me to be the artist in residence, and I was trying to imagine what I could do, I wanted to do something that was simultaneously very personal, but also expressed a multitude of identities. We had I had created in conjunction with them the Bandwagon over the pandemic, which was a pickup truck that went all through New York into 5 boroughs. And we did 81 concerts in a time when there were no live concerts and they were pop-up concerts and people were so connected. And we connected with so many organizations that partnered with us. And I wanted to be able to do that. But I, as a jumping off point, I thought about how as a countertenor, there's a gap between perception and expression. The way that I sound is different from the way that I look on some fundamental level. And how do we close that gap between perception and expression? And how do we, as some kind of outsiders, you know, me as a queer person or a countertenor being a very niche area of singing, how do we express our identity and also, engage people in that in a way that feels good to them? And art is really the best way to do that. So I created this series called Authentic Selves for the New York Philharmonic, which encompasses many different things from educational initiatives to collaborations with the National Black Theater, El Puente, Flushing Town Hall, Casita Maria. But it also resulted in 2 weeks of programming with the orchestra in which I commissioned new works that the 22nd Poet Laureate of the United States, Tracy K. Smith, wrote poetry for. Joelle Thompson and Greg Spears wrote new musical pieces. I brought Justin Vivian Bond, the incredible trans cabaret performer, to the New York Phil, and we did an incredible performance together. I became the first countertenor to sing Berlioz's Les Nuits d'été with the New York Phil, and that was a different version of that piece in many ways. So there were many things that we did to kind of explore how I could express my identity and how those questions of identity could expand to some of our partners, some other artists, and, you know, and be a celebration of individuality in that way.
Yeah. And these multidisciplinary collaborations, this is another hallmark of your work and of your career. I know you've got your project Glass Handle, and that's choreography, live painting, and costumes. What could you talk a little bit about Glass Handle and also what you want people to take away from?
Yeah. You know, when I made my first album, which was a combination of Philip Glass and Handel, both, I call them both minimalist, Handel maybe being a proto minimalist, but they both use repetition and a certain musical purity to express their voices. And so it was a really interesting musical combination. And I realized that, you know, releasing an album these days, there's hardly any way for it to have an impact with the streaming that goes by fast. So how could I create some digital assets and some live performance that helped extend the life and the reach of this album? So I came up with a show that was very complicated and really fun, that used some of the most famous people in art, film, fashion, and dance to interpret this music through their own lens. And my goal with that was to find audiences who were drawn to those different mediums and those different métiers, but who didn't necessarily care about opera. But if the fashion designer Raf Simons was designing the costumes, or if the painter George Kondo, the choreographer Justin Peck, filmmakers Tilda Swinton, Micheline Thomas, Maurizio Catalan, if all of these famous artists in different fields were all of a sudden working on a project that then their audiences wanted to come see it, and they encountered this music. And that's really what we did. We made these wild videos, which you can see on YouTube, with music by Handel and music by Glass. We made an incredible performance in which the audience was lifted up in their chairs and moved around to different parts of the space. And, you know, Raf Simons made 500 beautiful costumes for us, and costume items. So there were all different elements that came together, and different narrative threads that allowed different sections of the newspaper, different audiences and people through New York to start talking about the project. And for me, it was an experiment in how we could take something that could have very simply been a classical concert and an idea that was, you know, interesting but not revolutionary, and take it and expand it, sort of ring it for all it was worth.
Yeah, yeah. Well, once again, it's a little bit of that entrepreneurial thread, like when you went to all of the different departments to get the money for your project.
Exactly, exactly. Yeah.
So what projects are coming up? What's on your wish list? What's on your calendar? What kinds of things would you like to work on in the future?
Well, you know, I'm working on several projects, one with composer George Lewis and director Yuval Sharon. I'm working on a show that just opened at St. Anne's Warehouse in the fall, which is an incredible theater in New York. And that was my second album that came out, was a collaboration with the trans cabaret performer, Justin Vivian Bond. And we were inspired by Carol Burnett and Julie Andrews at Carnegie Hall, this kind of high-low dichotomy, not only high voice, low voice, but high class, low class, uptown, downtown, you know, tall, short. We balance each other in a lot of ways, but more importantly, we're true friends in life. And looking at that relationship on stage, well, it illuminates the music I sing, and then I'm stretched to go into areas I don't usually sing in. Mm-hmm. And that whole show, which we opened at St. Anne's Warehouse in the fall, was named the best of theater in the New York Times and the best of classical music in the Washington Post, and, you know, many, many other best of lists at the end of the year, last year in 21. So the collaboration of these two styles really struck a chord with many people. And it also expressed a queer universe that connected not only to queer people, but to a lot of people in thinking about how they define themselves. So the album, Only an Octave Apart, has been released this year, 2022, on Decca. And we're thrilled with that album. And we're excited to take that show forward as well with our collaborators, Zach Winokur, the director, and Thomas Bartlett, the producer of it. So I'm definitely excited about where that will go next. But I'm also constantly working to do education, to create opportunities for engagement around projects with institutions and outside of that, and learning every day how we can transform the industry of the arts and classical music, and how we can, you know, broaden and amplify the art itself. So I'm excited about a lot of projects to come. One dream role that I'm looking forward to exploring more in the future is Gluck's Orfeo, which was itself a reform opera in 1765 or 64 when it premiered, I think. Operas up until that point had been long, convoluted Baroque operas with many characters. And Gluck wrote this 90-minute piece, which was half ballet and half opera, and had only three characters. And I love the idea that we could reinterpret the reforms that Gluck put in place at his time for our day.
Yeah. So I don't think I've officially congratulated you on your Grammy. That's very exciting.
Thank you.
What was that like?
It was so thrilling to be there. And you know, it's very rare in the life of an artist that you do a project that you feel synthesizes all of the different parts of you. You know, my education at Princeton, my theatrical background, my understanding of art or film or dance, and then the actual part of singing opera and performing opera. And Akhenaten stretched me to every limit and really exploited all of the things that I had done in my past. And so it's a very special show for me. And so you can imagine to be the title role and for that recording to win the Grammy and to win a Grammy myself for it was absolutely thrilling and felt just right, you know, in the course of life. So I'm thrilled that people responded to it that way and still very grateful that the Academy voted for it.
Well, I have been speaking on Zoom with Grammy-winning countertenor Anthony Roth Costanzo about his remarkable life in music and many, many projects. Thank you. Congratulations on all of your wonderful artistry and future successes. I know we'll have to touch base again in the future and see what's going on in the future. Thank you so much.
I can't wait. Thanks. It's been a pleasure to talk.
Please don't.
Settled down.